Okay, we're reconvened. And we're beginning our post-break agenda with an update from Mark Hicks on clean water assurances. Mark, can you join us, please?
Good morning, Board. I'm Mark Hicks. I work with the Department of Ecology's Water Quality Program, where I sort of help to coordinate forestry and water quality issues. And one of the hats I wear is to track the Clean Water Act assurances. I know that a few folks probably are still not all that used to what the assurances are. So back when Forest and Fish report was negotiated and then transformed into rules, Ecology made some commitments that we call the Clean Water Act assurances. And that was essentially assuring that we would rely on the forest practices prescriptions along with the adaptive management program and the other programs of implementation to bring forested waters into compliance and keep them in compliance with the state's water quality standards. All that was based on assuming that we would have a healthy program that could do that in an effective way. There was a check-in period 10 years after the Forest and Fish report was approved. As in 2009, there was an assumption we have everything kind of already in line and figured out in 10 years. Shows people are optimists. Ecology did the review in 2009, found that we really didn't have the information and that a lot of it was a long ways coming. And so what we did is we put together a list of corrective milestones that if met would give us the confidence to continue with those assurances, essentially saying that we're going to continue to rely on the programs and processes as they evolve. So that's basically in a nutshell what the Clean Water Act assurances are. So one of the things that you folks have asked Ecology to do is to periodically give updates on how well we're doing at meeting those Clean Water Act milestones. And the current request was for Ecology to come every other board meeting and give an update. Turns out we missed one, so we kind of skipped a little bit here. It's been actually 9 months since the last update. And in the past 9 months, three non-SEMER research milestones have been met, and one SEMER research milestone has been met. And it's a long list of milestones. If you've looked at the list, you realize we still have a long way to go. But I also note that there are a number of others that are getting very close. There's work underway on several more of the non-project milestones. I'm very optimistic that those will get completed within the next 6 to 9 months.
SEMER, could you give us an example of a non-project?
For example, a non-project one would be getting a better online guidance, clarifying the process that's used for modifying water type. So that would be a non-SEMER research milestone. A research milestone would be looking at the effectiveness of the prescriptions in protecting bull trout standards. You know, that would be a little different. So I think what we're going to see I'm putting on two hats because I also am temporarily sitting in as a SEMER co-chair. And I think what we're going to see is in 2014 is going to be essentially a big year for the board looking at some of the results from the Adaptive Management Program science arm. So that's where in the next year and a half, 2 years, the number of those milestones that are on the science side of the equation are going to come rolling in. That's my expectation. So we'll see a lot of movement in the next, let's say, 1 year. Other than that, I would just add that we have a new governor, we now have a new director for the Department of Ecology, and we have some meetings to do internally, and we're setting up some meetings with DNR because of the non-project milestones in there, and the fact they run the Adaptive Management Program, to make sure that we're all on the same page moving forward with the remaining assurances. With that, do you have any questions?
Questions for Mark?
So have one question.
Go ahead, Dave.
Mark, in you mentioned, and as we know, Ecology did a kind of an evaluation in 09. What's next? I mean, I know that you guys track this all the time, and the board gets these updates and reports. Is there something, anything on the horizon in the future that's similar to the 09 evaluation that may be a little bit more in depth, or just kind of what's the process kind of going into the future?
Well, I'll be honest, we talked about that in 09, whether then we needed to schedule a formal second review, and decided to just not to make anything formal at this point and just see if we could get this first set of milestones through. And in truth, if we can get a healthy enough system, we're probably good, because it'll self-maintain itself.
Other questions for Mark?
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
All right. As Emma Pocket go, Mark Engel, please come join us.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair, members of the board. The Masama pocket gopher, a little critter that I do not know much about, but I will give you a briefing. And then board member Whipple will also add a little bit of information about the wildlife recovery plan. So this species has a high level of public interest, mostly from the perspective of development and county regulations. Because there are also species linkages to forest lands, a short briefing about the species is warranted, and that's why we're doing it right now. Information about the species. It's a small fossorial rodent, which stays underground most of the time. A regional endemic species, found only in western Washington, western Oregon, and northern California. It's primarily found on well-drained glacial outwash soils with grasslands or herbaceous vegetation. And many of these areas are supported prairies and savannas. Masama pocket gophers were formerly more widespread in South Puget Sound prairies, but there has been habitat loss to succession, agriculture, and development, and that has eliminated most of the prairie vegetation. They occasionally inhabit areas with sandy loam or gravelly soils when the tree cover is removed and herbaceous vegetation is established. Most of the areas with suitable soils in Thurston County are within city limits or within the urban growth area of Olympia, Tumwater, and Lacey, and much is already densely developed. In southeast Mason County, Masama pocket gophers are found on grassland and former prairie areas near Shelton, and they also occur in forest openings, roadsides, and the ephemeral herbaceous vegetation in recent clearcuts. So in December of 2012, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed adding four subspecies of the Masama pocket gopher to the federal list of threatened species and designating critical habitat. The 60-day comment period closed February 8th. We did not make comments. The final rule is scheduled to be published in late 2013, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposes 9,234 acres of critical habitat in western Washington. At this time, no forest lands are proposed for critical habitat. So with that, I will.
Thanks, Mark. We just kind of wanted to get this on the board's radar screen. It's a prairie species, but it does have slight maybe linkages to forest land, and so we just kind of want to get everybody up to speed on that. A little bit more nuts and bolts on the state side of things. It was listed as threatened in 06 by the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and then early this year, just a month ago, the agency DFW release a draft recovery plan and status update. Comments are due at kind of mid to late April, and it identified seven areas in the three-county area, Thurston, Pierce, and Mason counties, with substantial habitat and numbers of gophers. As Mark said, the species does occur in certain places in clear cuts on forest land where the soils are suitable. And so there's basically the message is there's a lot unknown yet about how this particular species utilizes forest land. But what we have seen is that if the soils are suitable and if there seems to be a source population and timberland is clear cut, harvested, there seems to be a flush of gophers inhabiting and utilizing that particular clear cut because of the vegetation. And then once the forest, the stand advances and shades out the herbaceous vegetation, the numbers kind of drop off. And so the current thinking is basically that they, you know, without harvest, they wouldn't utilize that area. And so our focus from a recovery standpoint is doing it as we move into the future is really focused on some research and monitoring to figure out really what's going on. We don't foresee any implications for forest landowners, but more of a learning opportunity. And depending upon what is learned in the future, we may work with forest landowners if the need arises to do something. But it's not envisioned right now to be kind of a regulatory type issue, because again, this the species wouldn't be in those areas unless there was harvesting going on. So we just kind of wanted to get that up to speed. And it's listed at the state level. Once the feds take action, then that'll kick off a 30-day a consultation between my agency and DNR and a recommendation to the board relative to any forest practices rules. So that's just the standard process that we'll go through.
So it's on the agenda today because it's timely. We've got a proposed listing and critical habitat out there. I know it had been a subject of some amount of discussion here at points in the past, and so it seemed like we needed to check in on what was happening. Any other questions for Mark or Dave on this subject? Thank you, gentlemen. Let's see, Mark, are you staying? No, just Sherry and Gary for our Taylor Check Spot Butterfly Annual Report.
Chair, members of the board, my name is Sherry Felix. I'm policy analyst with the Forest Practices Division. Next to me is...
I'm Gary Bell with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and my job is reviewing forest practice activities for their potential impacts to forest-associated species, which in this case includes Taylor Checker Spots.
So in your meeting packet today, you have our fifth annual report on the Taylor Checker Spot Butterfly. These annual reports implement in part the board's protection strategy for this species. A little bit of background for some new members and those of you who have forgotten our last report. In 2006, the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission listed the Taylor Checker Spot as a state endangered species. The board initiated rulemaking in response to this listing. DNR led a series of stakeholder meetings assisted by Department of Fish and Wildlife butterfly experts to explore and to understand the species needs, its known locations, the types of land ownership, and forest practices activities near the Taylor Checker Spot occupied sites, and the merits of regulatory and non-regulatory options for protection of these species. In 2007, the board unanimously approved the protection strategy recommended by DNR and supported by Department of Fish and Wildlife. That is a voluntary cooperative protection approach. The protection approach relies on a four-step process. DNR, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, tracking of forest practices proposed within 1 mile of Department of Fish and Wildlife identified butterfly habitat. DNR conditioning of those permits, the Department of Fish and Wildlife determines pose a potential risk to the butterfly. Voluntary landowner planning with Department of Fish and Wildlife to develop Taylor Checker Spot management plans for their land ownership, and these annual reports to the board by DNR and Department of Fish and Wildlife. These annual reports are to include two items: butterfly protection issues associated with individual FPAs and the status of landowner Department of Fish and Wildlife management plans. So for item number one, I'm happy to report for 2012, none of the 12 forest practices permits within 1 mile of Department of Fish and Wildlife identified Taylor Checker Spot habitat was determined by Fish and Wildlife to pose a potential risk to the butterfly. And no protection issues arose during these forest practices activities. So now Fish and Wildlife will report on the management plans.
So for an update on the status of our current management plan development, we have two landowners that we've finalized management plans with, and both of those occurred back in 2010. There hasn't been much activity from either of those landowners in or adjacent to occupy habitat. So things have been relatively quiet, but we're confident those plans provide all of the protection that we would expect as an agency, as we came to our concerning potential activities. We do have one additional landowner that we're currently reviewing a draft management plan for. We recently received some response to our initial comments to that plan, and hope to get together internally to review and discuss their response to our suggestions for improvement in that plan. Nothing very technical that would impact the protection that we're seeking for the species. So things that, a lot of that is mostly housekeeping related to the legal ramifications on there and potentially associated with the critical habitat designations. There could be some impacts to this group, so we're working with those. Got an additional landowner who has not implemented plan development to date, but they have reaffirmed their commitment recently that they don't have any activities planned at that location for the foreseeable future, like at way out into the 2020-2030 time frame. And we have some fairly exciting news about one of the other landowners adjacent to some occupied habitat up in Clallam County, where they finally closed on an acquisition where the Center for Natural Lands Management has purchased that property and put it into conservation status and has plans for restoration efforts and money available to begin restoration efforts on that site, which is adjacent to one of our known occupied habitats. So it's pretty encouraging. In terms of some of the conservation efforts by our agency in collaboration with many, many other folks, in the South Sound area, we've had continuing surveys as well as up north in the Clallam County sites to monitor our known extant populations. All of the areas in South Sound were covered for the most part, except for the Bald Hills, where we haven't had detections at any of those locations since 2007 and are fearful that they may be locally extirpated from those locations right now. At Joint Base Lewis-McChord, numbers were consistent with past survey efforts where they have a pretty robust population, some main production and translocation efforts, and continued vegetation restoration efforts there as well. And we have some additional sites here in South Sound where they've actually done reintroductions in past and this year, and the numbers there look pretty consistent overall too. They're actually up fairly significantly at one site, and the three others looked about equivalent to prior years, fairly stable, so that was good. At the North Coast, Collin County sites, numbers were again consistent with past years. For the most part, we haven't had any major decreases or increases at those. And we did discover one new site this year in Olympic National Forest where they had not formally confirmed that there's been checker spot presence, so that's pretty neat. So conservation actions that have been undertaken this last year include habitat restoration at three Thurston County sites and some large-scale captive rearing and reintroduction efforts at two Thurston and two Pierce County sites. DNR's also done continued habitat restoration work on the Bald Hills Natural Area Preserve with the hopes that maybe we can reintroduce some butterflies back out into that landscape. Center for Natural Lands Management has conducted habitat restoration on Thurston County sites for continued and ongoing reintroduction efforts there in some of the South Sound areas. DNR and WDFW have also partnered on continuing efforts for habitat restoration and enhancement on a couple of the sites up in Collin County area. A lot of that includes vegetation management more than anything, making sure that we maintain the species, post-plant composition that the species needs. And we've done some population genetics evaluation that's included many partners and funding sources. That's kind of in its initial stages. There's not a whole lot of result out of those initial undertakings yet, but we did some genetic sampling collection again this season, and we're hoping to get some results back sometime this year. And as Sherry mentioned, having reported there were no conflicts associated with forest practices for the species.
So going back to the plans, two of five completed, a third in the works, and then the last two, one sort of long range impacts are not evident, and the final one subject of a potential conservation transaction. What I heard.
Right. The Aloha parcel, due to the acquisition, we'll work with the Center for Natural Lands Management to develop a plan with them.
And the approval of the third plan is, are you waiting on critical habitat to be final, or what's the timetable for completion on the third?
That's a good question. it's actually been a fairly slow process from their side. It took quite a while to get a response back from them. And I expect some of their concerns and reservations probably still stem around critical habitat designation, but we're not waiting to move forward. As I mentioned, we just received a response from them last week, so hopeful that I can get staff together here shortly to analyze those comments, and then we can get back to them to continue that process and hopefully get it finalized with them this year for sure.
I think just from an overall perspective, you know, this species is state endangered, and it's proposed for federal listing, critical habitat. It doesn't have a huge nexus with forest practices, but it does occur on forest land, and so that's why we entered into this kind of this voluntary protection mechanism. The board approved that. Management plans are, you know, they have taken longer than what I think we all envisioned them taking. But I know that in the case of that third landowner, the economic downturn affected them. I think maybe things are a little bit better now, so we're again moving. The DFW was kind of going through the same things a lot of the time, so It has taken a lot longer, and it's not just because the pace of the landowners, because the pace and the workload associated with the agency staff as well. So I'm optimistic that we'll get that plan done hopefully relatively soon. We'll have to kind of see how critical habitat plays out, and I know that Mark and I are going to talk a little at the next agenda item a little bit more on that, but I'm optimistic. We got the Aloha parcel finally in conservation status. We had been giving the board updates and being really pretty quiet on that because it was kind of in a land transaction mode, and those things can be sensitive and kind of private negotiations. And so while we knew it was going on, we couldn't really say anything about it. So I'm optimistic. You know, we've got four of the large industrial forest landowners taken care of, and we've got kind of reconfirmed commitments not to operate close to or within the other site from the remaining landowner. And I feel good because, you know, the forest practices application screening process works, and that's our safety net. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in the next agenda item. But it's optimistic, and hopefully, you know, the commitment to the board is to, or the board's motion was to provide annual reports to the board on how all this stuff is working until the industrial forest landowners get their management plans done. And so I'm hopeful that that's going to be relatively soon, and then thereafter we can go to five-year reports instead of annual reports. So
it's important to get that third plan done.
It is.
We're pressing them a little bit.
Okay, other questions on this annual report subject? We've got a little from critical habitat discussion coming up here in a minute. Hearing none. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And Mark and David, you want to come tell us what's going on with listing in the critical habitat, please?
Good morning again. So you've just heard a presentation on the voluntary efforts to protect the Taylor's Checker Spot Butterfly during the BORS program. This past year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service took action in response to the settlement agreement with the Center for Biological Diversity to enable the service to systematically review and address the conservation needs of more than 250 candidate species over a period of 6 years. This includes the Taylor's Checker Spot Butterfly and the Street Hornet Lark. On October 10th of last year, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced a proposed rule for the Taylor's Checker Spot Butterfly in the Federal Register. They proposed listing as an endangered species and to designate critical habitat in Washington and Oregon. They also proposed the streaked horned lark as a threatened species with critical habitat in Washington, Oregon. However, they are not affected by forest land. The DNR prepared a letter, a comment letter to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we sent a copy to the board on the 12th of December. The comments specific to forest practices included that we explained the board's approach to the butterfly protection, as you've just heard your annual report. We provided a status of the approach, and that was at that time, and as far as forest practices, the 1 mile review area and for all forest practice applications, and I believe Dave's going to give you more on that. Suggested DNR, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service meet to ensure that the full value of the board's process is recognized in their final rule. Requested the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recognize all, not just some, of the sites currently under the board's approach as adequately protected, and you just heard very good news that we're making good headway on that. Encourage U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to fully consider the advantages and the disadvantages of non-regulatory approaches that are in place and working to conserve the Taylor's checkerspot butterfly and its habit on private forest landowners. With that,
just a few more things to add. I mentioned, I think, the last board meeting that this was going on, and so this is just another follow-through. And we'll keep following up with the board as needed in the future on the state listing and the critical habitat designation. At which point in time, again, just the formality of DNR DFW consultation and a recommendation to the board relative to any forest practices regulations. You know, it's a state endangered species since 06. And as Mark said, the federal government, Fish and Wildlife Service, is going through their process. I wanted to just kind of echo a little bit what DNR and Mark said about what they commented. And we had given the board and both sets of agency comments, I believe, that we provided to Fish and Wildlife Service on the list and the proposed listing in critical habitat. And our focus really was similar to DNR's in that we wanted to make sure that Fish and Wildlife Service understood what the board had done, the approach that we had adopted, and how well it's working. And we still stand by that recommendation and that voluntary protection mechanism, as we just heard from Sherry and Gary. And but again, we also encourage the Fish and Wildlife Service to work with us and the landowners on any programmatic type of federal assurances mechanisms that probably are going to be necessary, at least in the event that they do list and that they designate critical habitat where we have a forest land nexus. So that's going to be really important. So again, we're still committed to the ongoing process, and I think it's important for us to work with the feds to make sure that they understand it and they do their part in helping us implement these management plans and things like that so that we can get to recovery. So I guess that's all I really needed to offer and clarify. But basically, the take-home message, we're still on track and supporting the board's approach.
Thanks, David. That was an ill-timed drum roll. Forget the outside noise, please. Any questions for board members on status of TCB listing and critical habitat? Okay, hearing none. Thank you. We now have a ahead of schedule, well ahead of schedule, an update on a sort of a consequential point in the implementation of the HCP. We've got a five-year report from Carol and Charlene. Would you come up and meet us, please? I reserved a bunch of time on this agenda for this topic, and the reason is because it's 5 years. It's a significant event. A lot of work goes into not only implementing the program, but also painting an accurate picture of where we are in implementing the HCP and its terms and conditions, and Carol and Charlene are instrumental to us in that, and so they've got a presentation for us. Take it away.
Good morning, Chairman Everett and board members. My name is Charlene Rogers, and this is Carol Walters. We work in the Forest Practices Division, and we serve as the Forest Practices Habitat Conservation Plan Administrators. We want to thank you today for allowing us to come and give you a briefing on the very first five-year report for the Habitat Conservation Plan. And just for simplicity's sake, we'll probably from here on out just say Forest Practices HCP or ECP as we're talking through this presentation. The five-year report contains accomplishments, challenges, and trends that for implementing the HCP from June 5th, 2006 through June 30th, 2011. While we don't have time today to cover the entire report, we do plan to cover four sections of the report and some selected trends. We would ask, if you don't mind, to please hold your questions to the end. And that would be very helpful to do that. Thank you. We wanted to start by just giving a brief background for those of you who are fairly new. And in the 1990s, the federal government listed several salmonid species either as endangered or threatened. Four stakeholders in Washington convened a multi-stakeholder group in 1997. And after 2 years of negotiating, they produced an agreement called the Forest and Fish Report. The report delineated acceptable protection measures for aquatic species habitat. In 1999, the state legislature directed the Forest Practices Board to update forest practices rules to be consistent with the protection measures in the Forest and Fish Report. The board adopted those rules in 2001. Following legislative direction, the state then sought federal assurances under the Endangered Species Act for protection provided by these new rules by submitting the Forest Practices Habitat Conservation Plan to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and National Marine Fisheries Service, which is under NOAA. Together, we call those two the services. In 2006, the services accepted Washington's Forest Practices Habitat Conservation Plan, issuing incidental take permits to the state. The production of both annual and five-year cumulative reports are part of the state's commitments delineated in the HCP. The reports are a multi-agency effort with DNR, Ecology, and WDFW involved. Today, we'll cover, as I said, four sections from the report. I will present information on the Forest Practices Board and the Adaptive Management Program. Carol will present information on the Compliance Monitoring Program and the Road Maintenance and Abandonment Planning, which we call RMAPs. Then she'll wrap up the presentation with overall trends. The Forest Practices Board has experienced many accomplishments during this five-year time period. Several rules were either adopted or amended. In 2007, the board adopted rule amendments regarding perennial initiation points. This eliminated the option to use default basin size to determine the demarcation between non-fish and fish streams, because the adaptive management study findings showed that the default basin sizes available for use were incorrect. In 2008, the board adopted rules regarding long-term forest practices applications for small forest landowners. This authorized DNR to grant approvals for forest practices applications to small forest landowners for up to 15 years. This would help provide flexibility for timing for their management activities. Also in 2008, the board adopted rule amendments to clarify Class 4 special and Class 3 classifications for forest practices involving historic sites and other cultural resources. This addressed ambiguities and inconsistencies between Class 4 special and Class 3. Additionally, the language recognized cultural resources management plans from watershed analyses, as well as other voluntary efforts to protect and manage cultural resources. In 2010, the board adopted a rule amendment regarding desired future condition. This is defined in rule as the condition of a mature sand at 140 years. This increased the target basal area per acre to 325 square feet. Because adaptive management findings indicated that basal area per acre of mature, unmanaged, conifer-dominated riparian stands was significantly different from the basal area target required in rule at that time. The study also found there was no statistical difference for basal areas between site classes. In 2011, the board adopted rule amendments regarding the riparian open space program. This is a program that allows for purchasing 50-year easements. Originally, the program allowed only for acquisitions of habitat within unconfined channel migration zones. The rule amendment expanded the program to include acquiring conservation easements for critical habitat for threatened and endangered species. Also in 2011, the board adopted rule amendments regarding watershed analysis. The amendments instituted a review and reanalysis process for DNR to ensure watershed analysis prescriptions are up to date. The language clarified that if reanalysis does not occur where needed, DNR can rescind the appropriate watershed analysis prescriptions. And finally, in 2011, the board adopted rule language regarding forest biomass. This made it clear that forest biomass harvest is subject to the same resource protection measures as timber harvest in the forest practices rules. In addition to rule adoptions and amendments, the board also reacted very quickly to the disaster caused by an extreme weather event in December 2007, which brought heavy rain and winds to southwest Washington. The storm resulted in extensive flooding, extensive damage to forest roads, bridge washouts, numerous landslides, deposition of sediment and woody debris, and substantial tree blowdown along the coast. The board devoted its February 2008 meeting to understanding the disaster and its effects and committed to a thorough review of the potential relationship between forest practices and the impacts of the storm. The Forest Practices Program reviewed the Forest Practices Rules and operational guidance related to unstable slopes to determine if rule changes were needed to help protect against damage in future storms of this magnitude. In 2011, the board adopted the previously described rule amendments to watershed analysis rules based on these reviews. The Adaptive Management Program has also experienced several accomplishments during the first 5 years of HCP implementation. First, the Cooperative Monitoring, Evaluation, and Research Committee, which we call CEMER, completed 10 reports during that time period. For those of you who might be interested in reading them, you can find them on the Forest Practices website under Adaptive Management CEMER Research Publications. Second, the Policy Committee developed an Adaptive Management Program strategic plan. And third, several valuable changes were made to the CEMER work plan. And the CEMER work plan is an overview of all the research and monitoring projects and gets updated annually. There were three particular changes of note. The incorporation of a new section to each of the research monitoring programs called Link to Adaptive Management. This link helps the policy committee and the board to understand how well research findings address critical questions and if there are any remaining gaps in knowledge after study completion. There was also an addition of a table of CEMER projects, objectives, and targets. The table shows the complementary relationships among studies found in the annual CEMER work plans, as well as the status of those studies. There was also a reordering of project priorities according to whether or not they were answering critical questions with meeting Clean Water Act assurances. And as you all may recall, in 2009, the Department of Ecology prescribed a number of milestones that had to be achieved by DNR's Forest Practices Program in order to maintain clean water assurances. And while the adaptive management experienced several accomplishments, they also had some challenges. First, the efficiency and effectiveness of the review and approval consensus decision-making process. Basically, all participants have to agree for a decision to be made. This is very time-consuming and very difficult. The consensus review and approval process can challenge the ability of both the policy committee and the CEMER committee to complete review, research, and monitoring projects in an efficient and effective manner. Second, the availability of study sites. It can take up to 2 years to find a study site that might have the selection criteria needed, or even longer. Third, the availability and capacity of human resources to implement the program. Most participants are already committed to a full-time day job, and they are already involved in ongoing CEMA projects. That makes it very difficult to start new CEMA projects in the field. Additionally, each caucus has its own list of priorities which do not necessarily match. These competing priorities stretch already thinly spread human resources even thinner. Fourth, a particular project, the type N water's uppermost point of perennial flow, has been a challenge. Policy has not yet been able to establish a consensus strategy to identify that point. And finally, stable long-term funding for the program is a challenge. The Adaptive Management Program has been and will continue to work to find answers for these challenges. Additionally, the 2012 HDP Settlement Agreement addresses the adaptive management process improvements.
Good morning. I'm Carol Walters, and I'll be covering the remainder of the presentation, the accomplishments and the challenges of the compliance monitoring program, road maintenance and abandonment planning, and overall trends. It's been a very eventful 5-year period for the compliance monitoring program. First, in 2009, the compliance monitoring program established a stakeholder advisory committee that advanced the program's organizational structure and communication with stakeholders. The advisory committee that includes agencies, tribes, and interest groups is familiar with the forest practices rules and compliance monitoring issues. The stakeholder advisory committee assists in developing sampling objectives, changes in protocol, field forums, program structure, and also reviews program reports prior to publication. The stakeholder advisory committee also promoted the current field team structure. DNR, WDFW, and Ecology have dedicated staff for compliance monitoring, providing more consistency in sampling efforts. Also, the three agencies meet as a caucus more frequently to review and resolve staffing issues and rule interpretation. Secondly, the programs completed 5 annual samples and subsequent reports and 2 biennial reports. The annual samples field reviewed more than 100 forest practices applications each year. The sampling in these first 5 years has focused on those activities with the most potential to impact water quality and fish habitat, namely timber harvest in riparian management zones and forest road construction and maintenance. From 2008 to 2011, the program reviewed over 650 riparian or wetland activities and about 190 road construction or haul route activities. I'll briefly describe some of the results of the annual samples when I address the challenges section of the compliance monitoring program. In addition to the samples that looked at RMZ harvest rules and road rules, there were also focused emphasis samples that reviewed other forest practices rules during this time, such as wetland management zones, exempt 20-acre riparian prescriptions, alternate plans, and water and wetland classifications. This emphasis sampling included site reviews of an additional 200 activities. Thirdly, the compliance monitoring program was assigned 4 Clean Water Act milestones, and all have been completed. The program developed a compliance monitoring stakeholder charter. This document describes the scope and the objectives of the stakeholder advisory committee. The compliance monitoring program explored options and data collection methods for assessing compliance with the forest practices rules. This effort resulted in a document called the Rural Element Sampling Plan that describes how the program would carry out its work. The third Clean Water Act milestone, the program developed a field dispute resolution process. That process identified the basis for disputes and put into place measures to minimize similar disputes. And finally, the program assessed riparian noncompliance. It used data that it collected during RMZ compliance monitoring efforts, summarized site conditions and features where noncompliance frequently occurred, and developed strategies to improve compliance that addressed, in part, water typing issues, stream length measurements, a requirement for the applicant to notify DNR 48 hours prior to commencing an exempt 20-acre harvest, riparian harvest, and the need for additional training to identify type A wetlands. The sampling over the past 5 years that focused on timber harvest adjacent to riparian areas and road construction and maintenance brought to light several challenges. The compliance rates for most rule types were lower, some significantly, than the agency target of 90% or greater, particularly in the RMZ of the more complex fish-bearing streams. Within the RMZ, compliance rates varied by prescription type, that is, the type of harvest that occurred within the RMZ. Interzone harvest, DFC option 1 or option 2 harvest, or no harvest within the RMZ. In western Washington, compliance rates for RMZ harvest on fish-bearing streams from 2010 to 11 were 43% compliant when the applicant indicated a DFC harvest, option harvest 1, which is harvest in the outer zone and thinning from below in the inner zone. We were 60% compliant when the application indicated a DFC option 2 harvest, and that's harvest in the outer zone and harvest in a portion of the inner zone. And 64% compliant when the FPA indicated no inner zone harvest or where there was no harvest at all in the RMZ. In eastern Washington, on fish-bearing streams, compliance rates were 67% compliant when there was no entry in the RMZ and 78% compliant when there was no inner zone harvest. Compliance monitoring program protocol requires that non-compliant activities are evaluated and rated minor, moderate, or major based on the severity of their impacts. It's important to note that of the non-compliant RMZ harvest prescriptions in Western Washington, most received a minor rating, which is defined as impacts of short duration over a small area, such as a few trees harvested in the core, inner, or outer zones of an RMZ, are evidence of a small amount of sediment having entered typed perennial water. Another challenge was the compliance rates with road construction and maintenance rules, especially on non-industrial forest roads. The compliance ratings for 2010 to 2011 ranged from 60% compliant for small forest landowner road activities to 88% compliant for industrial landowners. Haul routes exceeded the target goal at 96% compliant regardless of land ownership. Industrial and small forest landowners were combined since haul routes cross multiple forest ownerships. To improve compliance rates, the compliance monitoring program is beginning to collect information to assist in determining why non-compliance situations occur. And the results of the compliance monitoring program are used to inform the rest of the forest practices program on where improvements are needed and will assist in developing the direction of the forest practices training program. Water typing is another challenge. Submitted FPAs too frequently report inaccurate water typing. A 2011 emphasis sample looked at water typing reported on the forest practices application and compared it to what the compliance monitoring team observed in the field. 22% of stream types reported as non-fish bearing on the application were observed to have fish stream characteristics and considered to be type F waters. As a result, the applicant may not be leaving the adequate protection required for the water type. To improve water typing accuracy, in 2011, the Forest Practices Division established a compliance improvement plan requiring additional information to verify water typing on submitted forest practices applications. Also, the program intends to continue with follow-up emphasis samples to check on improvements in water typing. sample sizes. Sometimes sample sizes were too small, and the results that overall compliance for an activity is low can be misleading. The goal of the compliance monitoring program is to maintain a sample of sufficient size to produce meaningful results. This will lead to a better understanding of non-compliant activities that routinely occur and allow for a more focused compliance effort within the program. We'll shift gears, and I just want to give you a quick reminder about the role of road maintenance and abandonment plans. Within each plan, road work is prioritized and accomplished in the following order. Remove blockages to fish passage, prevent or limit sediment delivery, correct drainage and unstable side cast, repair or maintain roads that run adjacent to streams, and minimize road interception of surface and groundwater. A lot of good work has been accomplished on forest roads. Completion of RMAP commitments have brought approximately 18,000 miles of existing forest roads up to forest practices standards. 4,258 fish passage barriers, approximately 60% of identified barriers, have been corrected, opening up approximately 2,200 miles of habitat. And the Forest Practice Program has improved data collection, evaluation, and reporting. This was addressed in part by standardizing data collection methods and establishing consistent interpretation of reporting elements. The most significant challenge to RMAP implementation was the impact of the 2008 recession, slowing the rate of road improvement. As a result, the Forest Practices Board extended the deadline for the completion of RMAPs for up to 5 years, or until 2021. While 5 years is not a long period of time to develop established trends, a few patterns have become evident during this period. Some of the trends are directly related to the challenges that we've mentioned and are serving to provide future direction to the Forest Practices Program. First, as noted earlier, refinements are needed to improve efficiency and effectiveness of the Adaptive Management Program, along with securing a stable long-term source of funding. Second, compliance monitoring results show less than desirable compliance, particularly for riparian management zone prescriptions and for road construction and maintenance prescriptions on small forest landowner roads. Third, there's been steady, ongoing corrections to remove fish passage barriers and make necessary road improvements to disconnect surface runoff from live waters through RMAPs and through the Family Forest Fish Passage Program. And finally, assistance programs such as the Forestry Riparian Easement Program, the Family Forest Fish Passage Program, and the Riparian and Habitat Open Space Program have not been funded at levels consistent with their demand. For example, in the Family Forest Fish Passage Program, 193 projects have been completed or funded through 2011, opening up approximately 500 miles of fish habitat. Currently, there are 611 projects awaiting funding. While we didn't specifically address these programs in our presentation, they are an important part of the five-year report. Again, thank you for giving us the time to bring you up to date on several aspects of implementing the Forest Practices HCP. We invite you to take a look at the entire report to get the full picture. The report can be found on the Forest Practices website under the Forest Practices Habitat Conservation Plan. One last comment before we open it up to you for questions. We'd like to acknowledge and thank all of those who contributed to the accomplishments and are working to address the challenges involved in implementing the Forest Practices HCP. It reflects a lot of dedicated work by this board, our sister agencies, our stakeholders, and the Forest Practices Program Division and field staff. Thank you.
Thank you both. It was a lengthier presentation than we tend to have at board meetings, and it reflects, though, the amount of work that's gone into this program over the 5 years of implementation of the HCP up to this point. And thank you both again for keeping track of it all for us and for that presentation. Are there questions for Carol and Charlene?
Thank you very much. For starters, in looking at the five-year report, I really appreciate all the time and effort that went into it. It's really nice to have this thing in front of us to be able to look at, because 5 years is kind of a big deal in terms of implementing this gigantic piece of legislation and rules. So it's really great having this in one spot, and it took a lot of work, and I appreciate that. One thing that I don't know if you guys can answer this question, but it may be better for Walt, but in terms of compliance monitoring and some of the areas of focus that may be needed in the future, I did notice in the compliance monitoring staff report that there were not going to be any emphasis samples for 2013, and I don't recall kind of just what the strategy is, and maybe it'd be helpful for the other board members to know, because of some of the concerns we have and in the compliance monitoring program as it relates to overall force efficient implementation, when DNR focuses on emphasis samples and when they don't, and kind of just that general philosophy, I guess. And I don't recall that, so I apologize if it's not a question that.
And Walt not being in the room kind of encumbers our staff response to that. We sure explain the strategy in greater length, and maybe next staff report or something interim if you'd like that.
I would agree with that, and I guess I would just say, as you know, all the stakeholders are involved with determining what is happening next, and they have an advisory committee as well, and so those people are involved with that. But when you want the specifics, I would agree. Let's get Walt down here.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Walt?
So thank you both for all your work and for the detailed report. I think one of the most concrete places you can see progress is through the RMAP, and so citing statistics like the number of roads that have been fixed and the number of miles of fish habitat that have been opened up are fantastic. I know that we passed a rule in 2011 extending completion of RMAPs to 2021, and I was wondering if you guys had, or any of the others of you had statistics about kind of how much is left to be done, so how many miles of roads still need to be fixed, how many large landowner fish barriers still need to be removed, and I know we've had some discussion about that in the past, and it might be that those numbers are hard to come by, but any comments you have on what's left to be done would be helpful.
Those were some of the reporting elements that were just added in the last 2 years. And actually, because of the reporting cycle with RMAPs, we'll have that complete picture with the 2013 report. We don't currently have it, but it's coming.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions?
I guess on a broader scale, it's been submitted to the federal government, and have they had any concerns?
Yes, it's submitted every year in the middle of December, and the five-year report was submitted as well. The annual report is five-year. As far as we've heard, they've been satisfied with the five-year report and the annual reports, but they always review them. They review a draft of those reports and get comments to us before we submit a final.
Other questions or discussion? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So with that, we are about 25 minutes ahead of schedule, and so what we're going to do is sort of proceed as the agenda is laid out. I think let's leave the general public comment session until after lunch. That was sort of a second public comment session that we'd instituted a couple of years ago now to accommodate folks who arrive in the afternoon. And let's begin with public comment that's pertinent to the Adaptive Management Restructure and Force Power Master Rule. Having such commentors? Thank you very much. Ready with the time cards. Par Whitaker. Proceed.
Thank you. Well, again, as a member of the Forge Practices Biomass Work Group last year, I was pleased with the level of consensus we reached among a diverse set of stakeholders in our assessment of the need for revisions of the Forge Practices Rules and Board Manual. Our consensus recommendations, which were presented to you last August, fit into three general categories: rulemaking or guidance that we requested of you, other requests of you, and third, requests made of DNR. Today, DNR staff will ask you for your approval to file CR 101 to define the forest biomass and amend the definition of a forest practice per our recommendations. I have summarized the remainder of our recommendations below, and I won't go through and read them, but just for your reference, with the hope that you and the DNR can begin to implement them. And you can, of course, find all the details in our final report. They provide a rare opportunity to be proactive and ensure adequate protection of our public resources in an emerging biomass market. Thank you.
Thanks, Carl. Mary, come give us a briefing on the initiation of rulemaking on the settlement of biomass.
Okay, I'm here for just what Aaron, the chairman of the board, said. Forest Practice Habitat Conservation Settlement Agreement update. The Adaptive Management Program has completed its review of the settlement proposal, agreement proposal. Policy then achieved consensus to request the board, and that's why I'm here today, to notify the public of possible rulemaking to reform the Adaptive Management Program. The Adaptive Management Program reform elements of the settlement agreement are, I can block them up in a couple of areas. The policy membership or voting, the dispute resolution process, and then also the master schedule of the CEMER or Cooperative Monitoring, Evaluation, and Research projects over the next 20 plus years. So I'm requesting the board to approve to begin the rulemaking process and direct staff with the policy, which to work with policy to complete development of the adaptive management reform, including draft rule language and board manual guidance to be presented to the board in the May 2013 meeting. I'm going to briefly describe what the agreements and consensus that came through a policy regarding the adaptive management program. One was improving adaptive management process for decision makings. What this involved was policy members of the caucus principals or their representatives. Policy is going to operate with one vote from each of the following nine caucuses. It was previously seven, and so now this is coming into nine. WDFW and Ecology will represent one. The Commissioner of Public Lands will represent a second. The East Side Tribes, a third. The West Side Tribes, a fourth. Conservation Caucus, fifth. Industrial Forest Landowners, sixth. Small Forest Landowners, the seventh. Federal Resource Protection Agencies, which include NOAA Fisheries, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and the EPA, would represent the eighth, and then ninth would be the counties. DNR is going to work on Board Manual Section 22, also with policy. In Section 22 is the guidelines for adaptive management program. We will also amend the ground rules for policy participation, making, and decision making. That will include these nine selected representatives. We will also then confirm decisions to make consensus through the nine caucus members. Okay? Second one, this is short, believe it or not. It's clarifying dispute resolution process and shortening decisions and timelines. Policy will work with DNR to draft the rule language. We'll also allow for CMER to utilize stage two in the dispute resolution process and to revise the dispute resolution timelines to a maximum of 2 months in stage one and 3 months for stage two. It was a 5 month for a total of 5 months for dispute resolution. Next one is to expand CMER dispute resolution process to require issues are not reaching consensus. If an issue comes forward and doesn't reach consensus, then it'll be moved to stage two and it'll go to policy for a decision for the adaptive management program administrator. And hopefully this will clarify the process for extensions and resolve non-consensus. And one more thing, and that is for prioritizing CMER work plan and establishing a process for a timeline for review and update. Policy will and DNR will work together to draft rule language, establish timelines, and prioritize the projects of the master CMER schedule. Within that, we will require the adaptive management program to complete work according to the master CMER schedule and establish a process for the adaptive management program administrator to report on this progress to the board and also to report the implementation of the master CMER schedule and policy. Another, along with the adaptive management program, that I am requesting the board's approval to begin rulemaking. What I would also like to, as mentioned previously, to open it up also for the Forest Practice Board Working Group. Why I'm combining these two or asking for the request for these, as previously in the recommendation, the advisory group recommended that the board manual for biomass be opened at a time when an existing rulemaking is already taking place. And so we would like to, as stated previously, include a definition for forest biomass and then also amend the existing forest practice definition. Those would be the two changes that we would also take part in this rulemaking.
Thanks, Mary. I think it's really important that as we're meeting our timelines for the settlement agreement rulemaking process, including the adaptive management reform elements of it, that we take the occasion to implement the biomass work group recommendations. But in other words, we've got one section of the rule open in which we could at the same time address a couple of those recommendations. I'm glad that we're considering that today. We need to also recognize, though, that one part of this group of actions on this 101 is required in a legal settlement, and another part that is not. In other words, the settlement agreement portion of it, we absolutely need to get done in terms of the rulemaking process by December of this calendar year. My hope is that because the biomass work group recommendations were a consensus process, that everything goes smoothly, and that the rulemaking doesn't get overly complicated with the addition of the biomass definitions. But you know, we need to be aware that if that happens, we've got to get the settlement stuff done. That's sort of the number one priority. So, are there comments from board members on, or questions from board members on Mary's recommendation?
I just want to thank the policy group for coming forward with a consensus on this. It was a difficult thing. The settlement did not involve all the caucuses, and the fact that people were able to sit down and work it out and bring us a consensus position on moving forward with this is just great. So I'm very happy to see this move forward.
Others? Hearing none, this time we've got a motion for consideration up on the screen there. Is there a board member that's interested in making such a motion?
I'd be loved to make a motion.
Tom's offered to make the motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Carmen with the second.
Can we read that?
I move the Forest Practices Board direct staff to file CRO 101 proposed proposal of inquiry to notify the public that the board is considering rulemaking relating to the adaptive management program and harvest of forest biomass. This rulemaking will incorporate recommendations as a result of the settlement agreement regarding the Forest Practices Habitat Conservation Plan and the Forest Practices Biomass Working Group.
Okay. Further discussion of the motion?
Second.
We have a second?
No.
Okay. Hearing no further discussion, let's call the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Any abstentions? I failed to ask that on the floor earlier today. No abstentions. All right. Excellent. Thank you. 15 minutes in front of lunch. Let's break a little bit early, come back at 1 o'clock, and clean up our last few questions for the day.